at the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land. Through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest. They built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps.
That was his dream, to not have to judge people by skin color. But if someone at a Black Lives Matter rally says all lives matter, which to me means roughly the same thing, they get shouted down. That's not cool. Now, I'm supposed to not be able to understand any of this because I have white privilege, which I don't believe in either.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counters.
Well,
it didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think about this stuff. I really do. I mean, I Martin Luther King and JFK would most likely be conservatives by today's standards.
Freak Fandango Orchestra leading us into this first episode. Hi, I'm Nate Staley. I'm a mental health therapist in Kansas City, Missouri. And welcome to Off Baseline, Perspectives in Social Science on Society. On this initial broadcast, recorded live to tape, Monday, January 15th, 2018, it's Martin Luther King Day. I invite my first guest, my pastor, Reverend Stephen Andrews. We'll reflect on the social, political, and spiritual imperatives laid out by Reverend Dr. King, why the struggle for broader racial and social justice are as relevant today as they were in Selma. We also explore the limitations of social media feedback loops and examine some of the pros and cons of asserting your opinions in a heated social media discourse. All of this and maybe more on Off Baseline. But first, I'd like to introduce myself and this show. So if you're listening right now, you may just be drowning this out, but if you are indeed listening, then this is likely your first time listening, since this is the very first podcast, so thanks for doing that. Show notes and blog posts and other related items, I'll be kind of posting them on the website, offbaseline.com. Come back often, feel free to subscribe to the podcast. You can also follow me on Twitter at Nate Casey Mo, or the show at Off Baseline. Also at facebook.com/AbagadoBaseline. That is ABAGADO Baseline. And there's claims that there is something inappropriate about the title when I type Off Baseline for a name for a Facebook page. So instead, I just went with the Spanish of off. This podcast will be in large part responding to news and politics, functioning as, you know, I'll be kind of coming at it from a sort of pseudo pundit, not married to a particular political party affiliation, as it were, but sort of from a mental health coalition building bias. And acknowledging with that the way things are, this means coming personally from a left-of-center perspective. Left-of-center tends to be the groups of perspectives that are for funding the means to do mental health treatment, to provide basic social services. And I want to be upfront with that. Acknowledging our bias is part of pursuing knowledge. Content-wise, it might not be headline for headline. I'll be looking at trying to apply theoretical discipline. So different theories of social sciences, of psychology, of sociology, of social psychology, of counseling theories. There's a variety of perspectives that, you know, can give you some tools to kind of look at news and analysis a bit more, you know, maybe from a different perspective, maybe kind of broaden your world through macro, micro lenses of the social sciences. This is a project for me born out of personal interests, of that sort of inquiry and educational itch that I don't really have an outlet for outside of creating time or finances where there isn't to get another degree or something of that nature. I'll be interviewing people from my world, colleagues and friends, which is limited based on my experiences, but I'm hoping that I can expand as this project expands and look at more and more types of guests I can interview. I'll also be looking to interview authors, researchers, other potential contributors will be pertaining to issues like the healthcare debate. Where does mental health funding fall in that? How do we pay for mental health care? How is the mental health care system affected by public policy? Who is affected by these policies? So again, it'll be a range from macro versus micro perspectives applying. You know, how does my vote affect this problem? How does the way I talk about something perpetuate or suppress attitudes, understandings? And what are ways I can understand the big picture once all is said and done? Hopefully, the world of mental health and social science is a little more familiar to you at the end of that and a little more illuminated. These are lofty and somewhat vague expectations, I know, but these are going to be ironed out as we go. Because direct experience is a fantastic way to figure out how to do something worth doing. That's kind of my beginning spiel. So for now, we'll take a brief interlude brought to you by the UK's, and we'll be back with our first guest, Reverend Stephen Andrews.
I got to know, have you seen a hazel? Last time I saw her, she was working tables at the corner bar, right across from the old church. She's so sweet, like lemonade on her front porch. And Hazel, and Hazel, and Hazel.
Reverend Stephen Andrews, pastor of Parkville Presbyterian Church, the church that I attend, to whom I affectionately refer to as Pastor Steve, welcome to this first broadcast of Off Baseline.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you. It's good to have, you know, I was trying to figure out, well, what guests should I have on the show? And then I figured out, well, I'd don't really
go
know.
For the people who are most available.
Go for the people that are that are most available. Yeah, you literally have
you
all
go.
Day, I'm sure. Nothing going on.
There you go.
But I appreciate you being on here, and it's MLK, Martin Luther King Day today, and I figure that would be a pretty good topic to sort of kind of ask you about. I know you've shared admiration of him from the pulpit and in groups, kind of among the congregation, study groups, that kind of thing. So let me just kind of ask, do you have a favorite MLK quote or thoughts about MLK? I think my favorite quote is the one where he warns us about shithole countries. But I'm not sure where I heard
right.
that, but... Pretty recent.
Right. Very big on obviously exclusion. That's a huge part of his legacy. And certainly disparaging others is a huge part of what it means to be a follower of MLK in today's day and age.
That was his thing.
Well, so I have a tradition on Martin Luther King Day that has just sort of developed over time, that on the church's Facebook page, I will post Martin Luther King's letter to the Birmingham letter from the Birmingham jail. And in particular, I encourage folks to read this letter and to reflect on its meaning with a particular orientation towards what are the movements that are happening in our world today that we may be ignoring, that we may not see as being at the forefront of justice. Okay. There were so many people during Martin Luther King's time, good people, fine people, including, you know, people who were religious leaders who looked at the movement that he was leading and said, that's the wrong movement, this is the wrong time, who said we should slow down, we should wait, we should see what the incoming mayor of Birmingham is going to do rather than, having this kind of upset, being incited.
Mm.
And there's no way that the regime of racial separation that he lived in and that he fought against could have possibly survived without the whole mass of good people, fine people who supported it, who didn't say a word against it, who may even have thought in their hearts this isn't the right thing to do, but didn't do anything about that.
Mm.
And for us today, if who are the Martin Luther Kings of our time? What are the Birmingham jails in which they're sitting in? And if they were writing a letter that we could read, what would they be telling us that we need to pay attention to? What would they be telling us about what caused for justice, about what great imbalance in our world? That 50 years from now, people might look back on and say, how could people have tolerated that? Because they'll have the clarity of history that we have now, when we look back on the Martin Luther King movement.
Right.
What will people look back on in our time and see that we're not seeing?
Well, and I think that's a pretty fascinating point. On one hand, I think I'm definitely not the first or even among the first to kind of make this observation even today, but that, if MLK, kind of were surveying kind of the progress over the past, however many years, I can't do math, 40, 50 years, since his death, they would kind of see, or, maybe he would be, somewhat pretty discouraged as far as, you see police murders, shootings in the news. You see kind of the awareness of like, okay, so maybe during the Obama years, there was this kind of confidence. Okay, we've elected an African American president, so look how far we've come. And then, the very next the very next guy we put in is making. You can kind of look at over the course of his lifetime, even before his presidency, and kind of what he represents. But even more so, in just kind of more so than just him, is a pushback or some kind of backlash in society. Talking about pushing up against the Black Lives Matter movement and calling that like a terrorist organization and the reaction that to kind of the election and Trump being elected, but even kind of beyond Trump, just the discourse and the level, and this might get to the next point we're going to kind of talk about, but the level of discourse to degrade so much and just kind of camping out into camps that we didn't really think we'd see in 2017 and 2018, mm-hmm. Kind of sort of. It's almost like expression I've kind of heard is, you know, we've just kind of thrown the dog whistle out and we're just kind of, you know, being more openly, blatantly saying the things that were kind of being said in the past 10, 20 years. And so on one hand, I think people, you know, I think we can kind of look back and say, you know, well, what kind of issues will be important to us, or what kind of major civil rights issues should we be, you know, kind of on the forefront of? And I think that's absolutely an important thing to look at. And on the same token, I think even just the same exact message that MLK was carrying out, you know, racial justice, economic justice, you know, it kind of talked a lot about how, you know, kind of fighting poverty and economic inequality is something that can't really be separated from the whole sum of racial justice and justice in general. As we kind of look at the whole situation, you know, are we really that much better off than? You know, when he was shot on a hotel balcony?
Well, I think that's a fair question. You know, when I talk to folks who lived through those times, the answer they tend to give me is yes. That, you know, compared to 50 years ago, we have made progress. We are racially in a different place. There is certainly the signs that we see in our society of a kind of backlash against progress, of a responsiveness to the diversity of our culture, that some people, you know, some people are finding the diversity of our culture to be upsetting to the way they think things ought to be, and they are responding to what they are seeing around them in ways that are reactive and harsh and sometimes violent. But still, even in the midst of that, I think we have made progress. I think we are in a better place than we were 50 years ago. But certainly there's so much work left to do. Mm-hmm. There may not be any, you know, legal segregation anymore, but it's very clear that there's informal segregation, that there are neighborhoods that are vastly majority white, there are neighborhoods that are vastly majority African American and Latino, and it's very clear that there are economic disparities between mm-hmm. those neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and it's very clear that there is a gulf between the schools in those neighborhoods and how well they serve their students. You know, on an educational right. level, on an income level, in terms of, you know, people having the resources that they need to get ahead and to live self-actualized lives, clearly there are still very stark racial divides in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly
even just looking at
police brutality.
City. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, police brutality just stands out as a flashpoint of all of the racial separation that's still there and all of the racial prejudice that still exists in our society. We just see it so clearly in these moments of police brutality that become broadcast to the world in ways that they couldn't have in decades before,
mm-hmm.
even though they were certainly still happening in those times.
Right.
It just becomes this crystallizing moment where we see it all very clearly, or at least we can if we choose to see it.
Right, and I think
you're saying even in
that's a big part of it. Yeah,
you're saying even in Kansas City.
Yeah. Just kind of the line of Troost Avenue is being a dividing line between historical, decades of enforced law, like actual housing policy, and law as to where you can build. I'm reading a book right now by Richard Rothstein called The Color of Law, and it kind of dives into that sort of the very specific sort of legal instances of institutionalized racial segregation and separation, and putting creating, so starting with the New Deal in the 20s and 30s, sort of creating these in response to the Great Depression, just kind of doing these public housing projects and just kind of basically a lot of those programs were exclusive of African Americans, and so that kind of basically all the all those programs of the New Deal kind of were a lot of much needed reform and much needed ropes to get out of poverty, but they weren't really extended to African Americans. And when they were finally addressing those needs, they were kind of separating them out into these different putting rules in place that made everyone comfortable, that said, hey, we're not actually going to, have these mixed neighborhoods. And when they saw they were naturally happening, they would, subvert them. And so after years and years of that sort of separation, but also, doing other things to sort of, taking some of the wealth out of those areas, you're kind of left with nothing to really build a wealthy, successful community with. So it's, just decades and decades, and really, since Reconstruction, we've just been having, kind of a maybe one step forward every 50 to 100 years, and then, kind of the rest of the time is just two steps back or 10 steps back, really. I mean, it's, and I think especially as far as being able to look around and looking at the diversity of kind of our country, and even just being able to, kind of look at, millennials as a generation, and just kind of pulling them as being widely, more acceptable or accepting of individual differences of different racial groups and opinions on, immigration and everything. There's definite hope there. So there's things you can look at and that you can be encouraged by. And I think we do need to be encouraged every now and then, for sure.
It's interesting to me that you bring up the history of how these racial divisions came to be, and how our current society is structured with these divisions in place. I think a big part of some of the divides we have over racial issues in our politics and in our culture has to do with whether or not we are willing to accept that this history is here and that it has a legacy that we continue to live into. I think for a certain subset of folks in the United States, there is an idea that, well, I'm not a racist. There's the this mindset that, I look at people and I don't judge anyone based on the color of their skin. And therefore what that means is that racism is no longer an issue, and race is no longer a barrier that prevents anyone from living into a kind of fully successful American life. But that viewpoint just totally negates this whole history of you know, I as a white person benefit from a legacy of people who have been able to build up inherited wealth throughout generations that's been passed down, you know, through those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And not only just, you know, pure dollars and cents, but because of our status in society, we've built up, you know, a certain level of dignity and respect, a certain kind of expectation. You know, one of the examples I often use when talking about racial privilege is I can remember when I was in high school, I and three of my friends would constantly cut class. There was just a particular, you know, arrangement that we had with a cross-country coach who would write us passes to go to the library during our study hall. And after study hall, we would just go to the parking lot and get in our friend's car and just drive away.
Nice.
And
that's a form of rebellion that wasn't even available to me as a homeschooled kid.
There you go. And part of why we could do that is that we, as four white kids, when we walked through the hall, even when we were going to places that we weren't supposed to go, we looked like we belonged.
Mm.
And, you know, if people looked at us and thought, hey, what's that thug doing there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we wouldn't have been able to do that. We would have gotten into trouble for doing things that we should have gotten into trouble for doing. But there's this legacy of whiteness that, you know, again, not just the dollars and cents, not just the educational opportunities, but just the way people look at you is shaped by race, and it's because of this history. And, you know, if you want to negate the whole history, then you don't see these issues, but the history is clearly there, the legacy is there, and of course the issues now are there.
Right. And so we're kind of at this kind of point where we kind of start to say, once that's being acknowledged, and that's a huge step to kind of acknowledge that and be aware of that, that's an entire, you know, level of, you know, personal journey of maturation and, you know, kind of talking as a community about it. And just to kind of segue a little bit, you know, I had the recent social media post that you made that spurred some thought that I wanted to kind of take beyond the Facebook and broaden the depth of conversation with, you know, some form of human interaction, at least with on the phone. You still get more nonverbals, which is kind of funny to say, but you catch my drift. So the post was kind of like a time hop sort of. Remember when you posted this a long time ago, and it was a quote from Barack Obama. And it said, democracy does require basic bonds of trust between its citizens. It doesn't work if we think the people who disagree with us are all motivated by malice or that our political opponents are unpatriotic. And kind of your commentary on that, just to provide some more context, is, you know, he said, a worthy reminder from just 2 years ago, fraying relationships, echo chambers with people from our side, and an assumption of ill will towards others. All these things have sharpened our division and paralyzed our politics.
Yeah.
I wanted to kind of ask you maybe share with me your inspirations for sharing that quote and what it means to you, you know, as a pastor. What sorts of experiences, maybe in the realm of guiding the flock, have given attention to this quote? Kind of in your in experience. It's a very kind of dangerous area to go in, because I can ask you, like, okay, who specifically has, what kind of interactions have you, you know, lost it? But no, kind of more... more generally, more broadly, has I should even just kind of go, has your kind of experience as a pastor kind of exposed you to this sort of I don't know how you want to put this, but sort of this dialogue grinding to a halt and just sort of everyone retreating to their corners.
Yeah. I don't think it's any secret among the people whom I pastor that I am a politically liberal person. I don't think I, you know, make too much effort to hide that. Although...
That's it. I'm leaving.
Fair enough. Fair enough. It's bound to happen one of these days.
Yeah, yeah. I can't believe it came out now.
So, no secret that I'm a politically liberal person. There have been times when I have been, you know, more active in expressing my views than I currently am. Mm-hmm. And part of that is that I felt that during the last election cycle, I felt that I made a very careful effort that every time I posted something on Facebook about politics, about a political issue, I felt like I was making a very clear effort to not disparage anyone personally, to make sure that I was talking about the issue and not the person, to really give some credence to, you know, the others, to a different point of view, to make it clear that I understood it and had some empathy with it. Mm-hmm. And I really strove for, you know, a kind of civility in the way that I was offering any kind of communication that I put forward around a political issue. And yet I would still have people who would come to me and would say, I saw what you posted on Facebook and it made me so angry. I saw what you posted on Facebook and it makes me feel like you're not someone I can talk to about, you know, certain things that matter to me. And obviously these folks who are coming to me are folks who are inclined toward a more conservative politics. Mm-hmm. And even as I was striving to be very careful in how I talked about these things, it was as though for them bringing up any issue at all from any liberal perspective at all felt alienating and infuriating to them. And I actually, you know, to bring this back to the earlier topic, I found that to be particularly true around any issue that touched on topics of race. That that was a particularly sensitive area, and that even very careful, well, at least I thought, you know, careful, sensitively worded posts about racial issues would be ones that would draw a reaction from people that I wasn't expecting.
Wasn't expecting that
decided,
kind of that they would wasn't expecting in the sense of they'd be kind of the effect it had on them or the perspective that they had, or what was kind of the most surprising element?
That I wasn't expecting the effect it would have on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't expecting that it would be something that would disrupt their relationship with me.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've mainly decided since the election is that I very rarely make any kind of political commentary on Facebook. And I've decided that the best thing I can do as a pastor is I make sure that my preaching is centered around the gospel. The gospel calls us to inclusion. It calls us to reach out to people across lines that might otherwise separate us. You know, Matthew 25 calls us very clearly to welcome the stranger. And I can emphasize those things again and again without having to make explicit reference to particular politicians, to particular political issues that are, you know, being debated on the national stage. I can make it very clear what the gospel says in my preaching, and I can lead people into ministries that will help them to expand their perspective, that will challenge their sense of what it means to be welcoming and how to welcome people and who to welcome. And that is a much more effective way for me to be political than for me to offer what it is that I think about national political issues, about which ultimately I can have very little influence. But what I can do is I can influence how people navigate their daily relationships and what kind of ministries they're involved in and how that shapes their minds and hearts. And I've decided that's a better political place for me than to be a commentator on the great issues of our time.
But so it's kind of separating out what it means to be political, kind of in a sense of, you know, there's punditry, you know, there's being verbal about it, and then there's maybe even kind of as a sort of leading by example, sort of pastoral kind of inclusionary guidance sort of role. So, and I kind of, as I was reading your post and just kind of sort of on a macro scale, so I kind of try to look at things from both a micro and macro scale, at least that's the objective of this podcast, within the context of social sciences and whatnot. And, you know, on the micro scale, from even just basically a Christian religious practice and personal ethic perspective, spiritually, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, and just kind of applying that to your interactions, not really wanting to alienate people. I co-sign that. From a psychological theory perspective, we have social comparison theory. So if we compare ourselves to other people constantly, you know, that's kind of what we do, and that affects our self-image. And so if we're kind of compared or categorized as racists or, we respond to that, and our sense of aggression comes from maybe that problem with the self-image. So when we're people are insulted, they attempt to demean others to sort of boost their own sense of self-worth or confidence. You know, if you're ugly, then you compare yourself to other people who you find uglier, and then layer on, you know, maybe they're unintelligent or, you know, other factors. And but the important part of this theory in that context with what we're talking about is when people are insulted, they're more likely to insult others. And there's the kind of, it's tricky because where do we kind of separate out, you know, some interactions might feel or seem insulting, you know, and to others, whereas, you know, you really, to personally insult them wasn't the intention or even expected outcome, particularly when it comes to sharing political views. And there's the Freudian concepts, you know, of ego protection. You know, we do what's in our best interest to protect our ego. So when we're backed into a corner, you know, we are aggressive. Or there's projection, coping with negative views of yourself by perceiving other people as having particularly high levels of that same negative view, which is essentially how everyone becomes a racist and everyone becomes literal Hitler. You know, it poisons the dialogue and stalls the conversation and the discussion, and which are, you know, helpful concepts when we want to really kind of see what our effects of our communication is going to have with people kind of on a one-to-one basis.
Trying to imagine having a conversation with someone where I would say, you know, I think you might be projecting a little bit here. And just wondering right. how that conversation might go
right.
from there.
No, it'd probably go like any number of conversations where I've unwittingly injected some level of my clinical counseling skills into my marriage life. Definitely not very well.
Fair enough.
From that perspective.
You
know, generally that kind of information, you want it to kind of inform you about how you are perceiving things. You know, am I just projecting here? Am I being aggressive?
Fair enough.
Do I feel like I'm being backed into a corner? That kind of educational piece is, you know, is from a relationship standpoint is not the best time.
That's reasonable.
Maybe a podcast.
There you go.
Yeah. And I had another thought too, is kind of on a macro perspective. So kind of logistical, political perspective. And, you know, one of my goals of the show is to use the vehicle of theories in sociology and other social sciences too. And I'm thinking specifically of conflict theory, that because the status quo is flawed with inequality and injustice, and sudden social change in the form of protest or revolution is needed to address these flaws, which is contrasted with functionalism, which, you know, emphasizes equilibrium, that systems have a way of gradually changing and advancing. Things eventually will kind of improve itself. And sudden disruptive change is undesirable because it threatens kind of the equilibrium. As we reflect on MLK, and we see that kind of social change in action, you know, freedom riders, the whole movement that kind of pushed to bring about systemic change, or at least to attempt to bring about some form of actualized change. You know, he was pretty aggressive while preaching nonviolence, you know, at the same time.
Yeah.
Like there's kind of that counterweight you know, he was calling people out. He was talking about, you know, he was anti-Vietnam War at a time when it was, you know, not widely considered public opinion was, you know, whatever America does is great. So why are you opposing this war? You know, he was for, you know, social programs for the poor. He was for like union rights, you know, those kinds of things. Like he was very aggressive sort of on that conversational level. And, you know, his words were very charged and it pushed the comfort levels of, you know, most of the country and people were constantly saying like, you know, maybe don't be so divisive. You know, and kind of a quote I had from, I was watching a TV, it was like an interview from the late 50s. And he said, they were kind of asking him like, aren't your tactics kind of, too aggressive, you know, or, you know, don't you think like you'll have a better chance at getting rights, you know, if you sort of, maybe bide your time. And because, you know, there was some serious threat of like physical bodily harm. And, you know, his quote was, I think it's better to be aggressive at this point. It seems to me both historically and sociologically true that privileged classes do not give up their privileges voluntarily and without strong resistance. So my question after all that, I guess. How do we find balance in this context if we're kind of acknowledging that maybe conflict is necessary for broader social change. You know, how do we seek that? Is balance inherently issue neutral, even, is kind of another thought.
I have a great hope for the church in the United States, for the church in general. And I think for our church in particular as well, I have a great hope that we can be a place where people can be fully themselves, can completely say what's on their mind, and then other people can be equipped to respond to it with their thoughts and feelings in ways where they don't feel threatened by what the other person said. They don't feel excluded by what the other person said, but they simply can hear and then respond, and we can enter into a healthy dialogue. Mm-hmm. Like, I have a hope that the church can be a place where we can situate ourselves as people who have different and perhaps very different points of view, but that we can be so trained in how to engage in healthy dialogue with one another that we don't have to hide our perspectives, we don't have to stifle our opinions, we can just be fully ourselves with each other. And I think there's a great possibility for the church to be that kind of place, because we already have the folks who are of different opinions. We already have the diversity of perspectives. And we have a strong theoretical underpinning for being able to be in dialogue with each other. If nothing else, we have the Trinity, which is this example for us of three persons, God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit, who are fully themselves, who are completely diverse, completely different as three distinct persons or personalities, and yet are one God brought together in this one divine being. And that this stands as a model for us of the kind of community that we can be. Again, fully ourselves, fully who we are, and yet united with one another. And a couple of years ago, I had my church leaders read a book called Transforming Church Conflict, which was essentially about nonviolent communication, the Marshall Rosenberg concept of nonviolent communication, just simply applied to matters of the church. And it was just all about training people so that when we talk to each other, instead of saying, you know, you're such a jerk because you think this and this, or you're such a jerk because you do this and this, we'd say, you know, when you did blank, that made me feel blank. And this is what I need from you. So that we could honestly talk about our feelings, so that we could honestly talk about, you know, our requests to one another. And then we could respond in ways that were not reactive, but responsive and present, and where we could be fully ourselves with each other. And I think on a political level, one of the greatest things we could do as a church in this fractured time is to model for the rest of the world that you can be people who have different opinions, who sit with each other, who don't have to hide those things, but who can just talk, and it can be okay.
Well, and so there's like those kinds of dialogues, that kind of empathy that's facilitated in that moment, is kind of rendered neutral or somewhat ineffective the more layers of separation you get from acknowledging each other as people, right? So if you don't really know a person or feel like you can allow yourself to know a person, if you have any barrier, any wall, whether it's a physical, you know, in kind of counseling theory, there's, you know, the more barriers, like physical barriers, you put between yourself and the client, the more distant the interaction is, the less likely you can kind of facilitate or develop a therapeutic rapport and actually kind of trust each other. And so social media is kind of starting from a place where you're already kind of separated on a massive level from the people that you're interacting with, that you're supposedly friends with, or, you know, the people that you're reading thoughts from or dialogue from. It's extremely disadvantaged in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my thought is that's kind of one of the most difficult things about why, you know, the way this past election happened and what everything that's followed from goes is like, this is the most kind of that a society has been kind of on social media, that has been kind of perpetually glued to that platform, that medium of communication. You know, I don't remember like my grandma being on Facebook when it started in like 2000, you know, when I first got on in 2006, when, you know, I first went to college and they were like, oh, you should check out Facebook. Yeah. And it was just like, okay, it's another social media thing. But like at that time it was just like something you kept up with if you were kind of into it, but not everyone in your family was sort of, you know, assigned a role to it in society. But that's just kind of it takes up such a space in our lives now that, that it's just more likely to happen. And, you know, people are sharing their thoughts freely on that form. It, you have all of that, those, outputs coming in, but you know, none of the, none of that kind of like a nurturing sort of relationship, none of the nonverbals or the, you know, kind of when you're kind of with someone, you might feel affected by their presence or kind of be kind of desiring to feel some empathy toward them. So, you know, really kind of, I mean, the major thing in practice is empathy. For being able to understand not just what we're saying, but where we're coming from as we're saying it.
Yeah, it's certainly striking to me how much of our conversation today, even before this moment, centered around Facebook and conversations that happened on Facebook and posts that were made on Facebook. It has become so much the center of the political dialogue that we have as ordinary citizens.
Right. I mean, it's the only dialogue we have.
Yeah, it really is.
Most days.
Yeah, since we can't talk about politics face-to-face with one another, we talk about it in the social media space where we can, on the one hand, more freely express our opinions than we might if we were sitting face-to-face, but on the other hand, where we can hide from each other.
Right.
Because we don't have to, as you said, we don't have to deal with the responses that people will have to the things that we offer. Certainly, I think it's been a space that, at least on the level of political dialogue, has been more divisive for us than unifying. It is certainly one of the platforms that helps us to enter into an echo chamber where we can not only make conscious choices to hear more from the people that agree with us, but there's an algorithm that makes sure that happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an algorithm that makes sure that, oh, those are the stories you like. I'm going to make sure you see more of those.
Right.
This is the person whose opinions you like hearing. I'm going to make sure that you see more of those, so that we just get this reinforcement of what it is that we already believe. And we start thinking that this is the only way to look at this. This is the common sense way to look at it. And you'd have to be a fool to be on the other side of this.
Mm-hmm.
How could there possibly be another perspective?
Right.
And it really does undercut our... Yeah, and it really does undercut our ability to be in dialogue with someone who represents a different point of view.
Right. I mean, it really just becomes the only interaction that we see. And you know, we do like things that are our general fall within our interests, and then there's the algorithm that kind of takes it from there in ways that we don't, you know, perhaps entirely understand. That kind of further cement us and wall us off into our corners. probably going to, you know, still kind of figuring out the structure of the show and how much time goes to goes to things. But I know we've kind of gone past what I initially bribed you to come on and talk for. So I appreciate your willingness
but I do
want
to, Well, I appreciate that. And I think I do want to add, as we move toward our conclusion, I think that the church continues to stand as a space where, you know, people come and interact with each other face to face. And again, given sort of the theoretical underpinnings that we have from our theology, given the fact that we already have, you know, the diversity that we hope to see in the kind of dialogue that I think we need to have as a society, and given that it is a face-to-face medium that is necessarily pulled together to see one another and interact with one another, you know, I still think the church holds out this wonderful potential for being part of the movement that that draws us back toward having a common enough vision that that we can move forward together, and for providing space enough to talk enough so that we can start to deal with some of these issues. That's my last thought.
Yeah, no, that's I appreciate your thoughts, and I think this is a conversation that could even, you know, kind of continue, or at least I'll continue thinking about it kind of beyond this. But as we draw this conversation, you know, to a close, a feature of the show that that they'll be kind of instituting mandatory coping skills at the end of each show, because we're constantly bombarded and overwhelmed by what's in the news, by the topics we've discussed, by realizing these sorts of, you know, even, you know, today talking about these systemic and personal injustices. So I was just going to throw this on you. Do you have a favorite coping skill?
That's a good question. And you know, I don't mean to sound hokey with it, but prayer. I think when I am kind of most at the end of my rope with society or with an individual relationship or with whatever it may be, you know, I find that I need to pray for the person that I may be having some tense dialogue with. I need to pray over the issue that is most drawing my anger or sadness. Mm-hmm. And at the very least, prayer gives me a sense of perspective that there has been a world for billions of years before this moment. There will be a universe for billions of years after this moment. There is a God who is above all of these things, who holds it all together. And this particular thing that I'm offering up is, you know, just one grain of sand on the beach. And that at least helps to give me a sense of peace about the thing that has been giving me turmoil.
Well, that's, terrific. And I want to kind of invite, you know, there's probably, I would imagine, I don't know if who listens or who will listen or, you know, whoever, if anyone, but, you know, there might be some from that come from a non-religious background, who are, you know, kind of, I would like to extend this kind of invitation to say that there's a variety of, you know, different kind of ways to kind of cope and reflect and
one can meditate and get to this kind of place.
Right, exactly. And so just kind of extending that as well. And you've made some mention of the fact that you kind of come from sort of having being an atheist at one time.
Sure, yes.
Coming from that perspective, so you can appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So kind of for lack of... you know, I didn't warn you about that I'd be asking you about a coping skill. Do you mind leading us in your preferred coping skill to kind of close out the podcast here?
Oh, sure. Let us, If you will, join me in a word of prayer. God of many names and many faces, we give you thanks for all of the ways in which you bless us and give us the things that we need each day. We pray that spiritually, emotionally, physically, and intellectually, you will continue to feed us, continue to inspire us, continue to give us strength and hope, so that, Lord, in the face of the many things that be subtle and anger and sadden us and confuse us, that we may continue to move forward, continue to express the voice that you have placed within us, and may we continue to be a people marching forward in hope. And we ask this in your name. Amen.
Amen. Thanks for being thrown into that, and you came out of it pretty good, I thought.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I appreciate you playing along, and so that's what I'll be doing to my guests unwittingly until they figure it out anyway.
Very good. Very good.
So, Pastor Stephen Andrews, I appreciate you being on the first podcast of Off Baseline.
Very glad for the privilege.
Awesome.
And we're going underground. And we're going underground.